Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the Mueller Report and the executive-legislative showdown. And Richard, all signs continue to point to the fact that we are not going to be free of the Mueller Report and its subsequent fallout anytime soon. The big controversy on the week we're recording this being the revelation of a letter that Bob Mueller, the special counsel, sent to William Barr, the attorney general, complaining about how the summary of Mueller's report that Barr had released to the public before the full document was available had characterized some of the report's findings. Now, the debate that has ensued subsequently over this has broken down roughly as follows. You have critics of the administration who see this as validation of the criticism that they've been making all along, that Barr is sort of fundamentally unreliable, using his office to spin for the president. And then you've got people on the other side saying, look, Mueller didn't say that Barr really misrepresented anything. There's actually not a lot here. So Richard, help us navigate this. How should we think about what Mueller is actually trying to say here? How should we think about Barr's role in this whole process?
Well, I think it's an extraordinarily complicated issue. But I think that the basic problem here is who is now in charge of this particular investigation after Mr. Mueller has sent his report to Mr. Barr. And the way in which Mueller put the report is he left it open at that particular time on the obstruction charges, whether or not there was enough grist for the mill for Congress to continue the investigation. That's a decision for Congress to make. And in my view, it was improper for Mueller to even put that suggestion in because it was outside the terms of reference of that he was supposed to do. He made a recommendation that there be no prosecution because of insufficient evidence on the collusion charge. He said there was insufficient evidence thus far on the obstruction charge, but Congress could find otherwise. The second part is not part of his business. Emmett Flood actually wrote a very strong letter in which he said you went outside your terms of references when you did something which somebody else is not supposed to do. Now, the second thing that happens is if you look closely at the letter of March 27th that was signed by Mueller, he is, in fact, protesting the way in which Barr has handled the question and has decided that he should be the one to do the redaction and so forth. And what he said, in effect, is his situation. He said, what happens is we prepared for you a letter and a summary and a redaction, which they think worked very accurately with respect to the situation, and that you should have published them. So he said, accordingly, the enclosed documents are in a form that can be released to the public, consistent with the legal requirement and departmental policies. I'm requesting that you reply these materials to Congress and authorize their public release at this time. And now he is referring to an introduction and an executive summary for the both volumes of the report that he himself prepared. So essentially, all he wants Barr to do is to be a cipher and to simply transmit what Mueller had done by way of summary out to the other side. That is, again, outside the terms of his reference. He's supposed to give the report, then the attorney general is supposed to decide what to do with it. He then goes on to say that I think that the summary of the letter that you released did not fully capture the content, nature, and substance of this office's work and conclusion, and that we earlier mentioned that to you. So he is, in fact, accusing Barr of making inaccuracies. Now, my sense about this is if you believe that there is some kind of an error of that sort, you cannot stop with that particular allegation. What you have to do is to then give a bill of particulars and to say, well, here is something that you said. Here is what you should have said. Here is the particular difference, if you're going to do this at all. But he didn't do that in the letter. And in fact, we have no idea what he thought was wrong or why it was wrong. But what happens is once this particular letter gets leaked to the public, now what we do is we have an undocumented charge in which essentially Mueller is charging Barr with acting in bad faith on this kind of a question. So I think these are really very, very serious charges that are made. And then the question is, the Democrats want to take this up. And Mueller's strategy, I think, is exceedingly clever but wholly improper. So I'm mentioning nothing by way of particulars. The obvious invitation is, all right, Congress, you now get Mr. Barr in front of you, and you get him to explain why it is that he's done the report the way he did it. And hopefully, at that point, Mueller would think that his summary would somehow or other get its way into the hands of the House committee or to key senators on the Democratic side, and they would then have a field day trying to run a comparison between the two documents. That's what I think is at stake. And in my view, this investigation at this point is something that is done and in the control of Barr. And I don't think it's appropriate for Mueller to say these kinds of things in a letter unless he gives the particulars. The interesting feature was, and omitted from this letter, is that Barr actually took his summary of the material and sent it off to Mueller to see whether or not he would make any comment. And he did not make any comment on that. He should have done so. And if he doesn't do that, I treat it as a waiver of what's going on. But I can assure you, anything that I say about this is not going to persuade a single Democrat who's intent on getting two people's scalps, Mueller's, rather Barr's and Trump's, and they will do everything they can in order to do it. So I think what's happening is that this letter was a conscious effort to up the ante in the particular case, and I think it's had its desired effect. We are in for a wholesale battle between the president and Barr on the one side and the Democrats, and what makes it even worse is the question of what are they trying to do with this particular hearing. I don't think they are trying to get the obstruction charge to basically stick. I think what they're trying to do is to head off any investigation that Barr might make of people and operatives in the FBI and elsewhere with respect to the interventions in the presidential campaign on the Democratic side in the run-up to the 2016 election. And I think there's a lot of stuff there that might be extremely difficult, and there are a lot of political judgments and legal judgments that have to be made. And if they can destroy Barr's credibility on this particular issue, they will prevent the kind of scrutiny that they may not want to face from happening. So this is a two-front war, and it turns out that at this point the Democrats are trying to win by slowing down this investigation so that the other investigation of their operatives will not take place.
And I want to come to that investigation, but there's an intermediate structural issue I want to ask you about, because the president has taken the position that the report's out, everything's done, we just need to move on. And part of that has been an effort to tell the Congress that they're not going to play this game on the Russia probe anymore. So they've talked about ignoring subpoenas for people like Don McGahn, the former White House counsel. You just yesterday had the Attorney General refuse to appear before the House Judiciary Committee after appearing before the Senate one, because he was said he was willing to submit to questioning from committee members but not from committee lawyers, you know, non-elected officials. Democrats in Congress have talked about holding people who refuse to comply with these subpoenas in contempt. They've talked about fining them. How should we think about this in terms of the interbranch dynamics, Richard? Is this all within Congress's legitimate oversight responsibility, or does the administration have a case that they're pushing this too far?
Well, it's certainly a case both ways. I believe the administration is more correct on these issues. I think it would be indefensible if they simply decided that they would not appear at all and would claim executive privilege with respect to anything and everything that had happened, including documents that were already released. But what's happened here is, in order to figure out what you do in the case of a current controversy, you try to look at customary practice to see the ways in which these investigations have come to some kind of a conclusion. As best I can tell, nobody has ever submitted an attorney general to questioning by a staff, and there's a very strong reason why it is that Gerald Nadler wants to do that. He's trying to make this look as though it's an inquisition in order to set the stage for some kind of a criminal prosecution. That's why we put lawyers on you, we're giving you the third degree. If he has to do it by himself, then it looks like more of a traditional investigation. I think symbolism in these cases is extraordinarily important, and I think Barr was right to say that he's not going to put himself up to an examination by a series of lawyers on a set of trick questions that will make this look as though it's a deposition in public. Now, the Democrats, of course, could have backed off of that demand, but instead what they did is they doubled down and they start talking about fines, start talking about sanctions, start talking about contempt, start talking about impeachment. And I think at this point we've really gone into a very dangerous state because it looks as though this is becoming a kind of a political criminal trial. And Nancy Pelosi describes this as though it's criminal behavior with all the other shenanigans that go on in politics. And she does this with a straight face without ever once alluding to anything that happened in the run-up to the 2016 campaign. It's quite clear that what they are trying to do is to neutralize the Justice Department by a series of attacks. Do I think they will win? No, they certainly do not have the power of execution in and of itself. They're going to have to go and try to get these subpoenas ratified in court over the opposition. And at this point, we have yet another trouble. What does it mean to talk about congressional oversight? There is no question at some level that Congress is allowed to make investigations for multiple purposes. One is always with the question of what kind of new legislation do we think we need to put into place in light of various kinds of misdeeds that have happened. And it also has to do with appropriations for various kinds of committees. So it's a very large hook that they have, and I don't think anybody could deny it. But on the other hand, I think what they're really trying to do in this particular case is to figure out whether or not they could get some information, then use it for the basis of criminal charges without trying to go through the formal processes associated with an impeachment sort of case. And I think that's a much more dubious sort of purpose with respect to what's going on here, because I think they're not trying to inform themselves on how to deal with the executive branch on issues having to do with policy and probity. I think what they're trying to do is to assemble a case against the president and against Barr and against anybody else in the office, which they believe will be the grounds for some kind of an impeachment hearing or some kind of referred criminal prosecution. And remember, even if the president is rightly understood not to be subject to criminal prosecution while he's in office, that particular benefit does not go to key staffers that he has, present and past. So this is likely to be a complete battle royal. Just one other complication that makes it more difficult for the president is many of the documents that may be the subject of examination or conversations that were subject to release in the Mueller report may be the kinds of things on which Congress wants to talk. And so there's always going to be the question of whether or not there's at least a partial waiver to the kinds of things that are going on in this particular case. And so what I can say with complete confidence is nothing that I believe will deter any Democrat from pushing maximum. But I think that now that we don't have Jeff Sessions in power, but you have somebody who, in fact, has got the full powers of the office, now that Rosenstein is gone, what happens is you will have a coherent Justice Department pushing back, and this will not be the way in which things were a year or two ago when Jeff Sessions was outside the picture. And as I've always said, and I've continued to iterate, the single biggest blunder that Donald Trump made was taking a guy who was a reliable senator, putting him in as an attorney general when he knew that he had to be damaged because he was so close to the political campaign that the president ran. And he should have never made that appointment. Sessions should have never accepted that appointment. Just think about the way in which the world would look today if Bill Barr had been made attorney general in January of 2017.
The president, in a tweet earlier today, suggested, as he has on a few occasions now, that the real story here is what he refers to as the spying that was going on of his campaign in 2016, which he characterized today in the tweet as bigger than Watergate, but the reverse. So the president's use of superlatives there might cause some people to discount the argument. But Richard, from what we know, how serious a case is there that the way in which the Trump campaign was being observed crossed a legal line?
Well, I'm pretty sure that they did cross a legal line. I just don't know how far and how many people. But let me give you the kinds of questions that I would want to ask. First of all, you have something about the Steele report and its very dubious provenance. We know it was funded by the Democratic National Committee, but we also know that Hillary Clinton was a presidential nominee of that committee. And it's a perfectly legitimate question to ask. Did she know about this report? Did she authorize it? Did she authorize the funding for this report? Did she review the report before it was sent over? So far, she has simply been kept out of this particular loop, and yet she has the general reputation of being something of a control freak. And so the question is, how credible is it that she had no part to play whatsoever in what was obviously one of the largest strategic decisions in how it is that her campaign will run? So I may not be in favor of criminal prosecution. Generally, I'm opposed to of going after anybody, no matter how egregious their conduct, who is a political rival, and I still stand to that. But if somebody were to put her under oath and ask her what she was to tell, giving her immunity from prosecution and going after people in the FBI, I do not think that that is completely legitimate, but it's obviously going to raise the roof one way or another. And I think the Democrats are frightened about that, because unlike the situation with respect to collusion, where they had no evidence going in whatsoever and could find nothing, in this particular case, we've got lots of evidence that they cut a lot of corners in an effort to continue the investigation. When there was some belief on the part of the FBI that the Trump administration may have been in some sense compromised or infiltrated by some of its low-level operatives, they did not have the courtesy to inform them of that. We know that there were conversations in there between Lisa Page and Peter Strzok, so about how it is that we have to get this kind of administration and the kinds of steps that they would do it. We also knew that they all thought that if Hillary Clinton did win the election, that none of this stuff would ever become public. So there's a lot to look at in that. The person who's most on top of this are Andy McCarthy on the one hand and Kim Strassel. They're both very strong partisans, but it's interesting to see the way in which they write about the stuff and the way in which the Democrats write about the stuff. They are always giving particulars, verse, chapter, and so forth. Whereas the Democrats are always saying it's just preposterous to say that we spied on them. It's a very powerful word to use, short and to the point. At this particular point, however, Barr has indicated he's not backing down on the use of the term. And the question is, why should he? Remember, this is at this stage an investigation, and what you need in order to conduct an investigation is less than what you need in order to bring a criminal case. And what the Democrats are afraid of is that some information will come out which may not be strong enough to support criminal indictments, but may be strong enough to embarrass them and to put them into a very awkward political position. So they are pushing doubly hard on Barr because they want to prevent that eventuality from ever taking place.
The final question that I'll put to you: for decades now, we've been dealing with these special investigations. It's Watergate, Iran-Contra, Whitewater, the Valerie Plame case during the Bush 43 administration, now the Russia probe. Richard, do we have an effective framework for how to do these things? Is this a decent institutional equilibrium? Because to an outsider, they always seem extremely prolonged, extremely disruptive, and not always that effective. I mean, is that just the cost of doing business, or is there a better way to hold the executive branch accountable?
Well, I think it's actually an extremely difficult question, and let me put it in the following way. The reason why Watergate went the way in which it did is it was at some level bipartisan, by which I mean when Sam Erwin and the other Democrats decided to push for the impeachment, there was no resistance on the part of the Republican side. They might have wished that it would disappear, but they knew that the case was sufficiently strong that there was nothing they could say against it. So this was certainly disruptive. Nixon acted out in many strange ways. But in the end, if you knew that he had the tapes, you knew that he could not keep them secret, this would be clearly an obstruction of justice case. It's clearly something that would be the grounds for impeachment. It would be impossible to say that Congress is going to be faced with executive privilege when it's bringing an impeachment case against the president. And so this thing went. But now what we do is there is literally no overlap between the most conservative Democrat and the most liberal Republican. And in fact, the movement in this particular term on the Democratic side has been, in terms of its most conspicuous people, its potential presidential nominees, moving ever further to the left. So Nancy Pelosi was trying to hold this thing back by saying she thought that impeachment was ill-advised, and I think she's worried about being inundated by her own party, and so now she starts using the phrase criminal conduct with respect to Barr, and I think that means that she is moving over to the left because she doesn't think that she could stand against the kind of tidal wave that's coming up against the president inside the Democratic Party. So they've moved way over. And it is clear that they have no desire whatsoever to collaborate or to win any Republican support on this side. The Republicans, I think, in Congress are somewhat ambivalent about all of this because many of them are very uneasy about some of the antics and shenanigans of the Trump administration. But they can't bring themselves to join into this. Then the question is just how much will they oppose it? And at this particular point, I guess the Republican behavior inside the House has been one, if I'm not mistaken, of deafening silence. They really haven't stated much. But the executive branch has no such doubt, and Trump has a team which is much more coherent than the one that he had in 2017. So we are going to see a complete Donnybrook, and I don't think there is any way to stop it. And remember, we've had other cases where things have gone off the rails with Ted Olson and Alexa Morrison. That was a prosecution that simply became unhinged, and the Scalia opinion, which explained why it was that this examination was a wolf that came in wolf's clothing, is an immortal line which led to the abolition of that office. Well, right now, it turns out we're back in the same game. But remember, that was going after Ted Olson, Office of Legal Counsel guy, not a big shot in any sense of the word. Now you're going after the Attorney General and the President of the United States. You have the same political dynamics, and you quadruple on the particular states. And there's absolutely no institutional reform that I can think of which will let these guys work. Essentially, Troy, just to end on this note, the only way in which interbranch operations can work is if there's some notion of comity and civility is between the two parties. Otherwise, it's just going to be bone against bone. And all of that comity, all of that civility has long been lost. You can blame the president for part of it. You can blame the Democrats for part of it. But I don't see any way in which this rupture can be repaired. And I think there's going to be a long, cold time talking about all this stuff. And I do think that Mr. Mueller gets a very large share of the blame, because he should have just submitted his report and remained quiet. But what he was determined to do was essentially keep the game alive, even though he had come up empty, and he has succeeded beyond his wildest dreams and beyond my greatest fears.
All right. You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.